The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow authors about their process and technique.
So this is episode 30, and we recorded this. This is with Jen Kalea, who is a translator, poet, short story writer. Not that she's doing a PhD at the moment, dealing with some very interesting stuff that we talk about.
Yeah, we covered quite a range of topics and formats.
Yeah, from the safe confines of our own homes during the great COVID-19 lockdown of 2020.
Yeah, I think this will be going out in the middle of May, so hopefully at that point in the future we will be released from lockdown and free to roam. And free to go on buses as well.
Which, I mean, we're jokes. Flourishing in the barter system now, aren't we, really? Yeah, so that was an interesting thing you'll hear about, is Jen uses bus travel as a way of sort of clearing her mind out and not having any distractions, the normal household distractions around for her writing in the early stages, which has obviously been curtailed by social distancing.
Yeah, it's quite a novel. I think a lot of people we've spoken to say they go for a walk, or they go on public transport to sort of get ideas going and then come back and write. But Jen seemed to go a step further and write the bulk of her short stories on buses, travelling in and out of London.
It's an interesting approach. Here is Jen Kalea. Do you work as a translator as well? We're sort of obviously talking to you while you've got your collection of short stories out, but do you write your own sort of prose fiction, poetry and stuff? Do you have a regular routine for your own writing?
Well, basically, because of the nature of translating novels, I can kind of set my own timetable. Which means I can basically do whatever I want whenever I wake up on the day. So if I feel like translating, I translate. If I feel like writing my own stuff, then I do that. So my kind of day-to-day life might look like sitting down at the desk and thinking, do I want to try and bash out a draft of a chapter of a novel, or is there an idea for a short story that's really kind of burning that I have to get down. Or it might be writing an article or a review. It normally depends on what I'm getting paid for.
Uh-huh. would you work on different things in the same day, or do you find that when you're in the middle of a translation, the headspace isn't there for your own writing?
Yeah, the ideal is to keep working on a translation on successive days. So I try and block out whole weeks where I'd only do translation, but I have to be really focused and really motivated to do any writing at all. So I try and follow my gut. If I start working on a translation in the morning and I'm really just struggling to get anything out, I will swap and try and do a draft of a story or something else. So I'm not rigid. It really, it sounds quite airy-fairy, but it really depends on what I'm feeling like.
Yeah, but I guess it's whatever works to get the words down and to get yourself writing, isn't it? So
yeah.
I think you've got that flexibility is probably just a very good thing to have.
And when you sort of start writing a new piece, are you normally sort of working from notes that you've prepared or built up beforehand, or do you just have an idea in the morning and start writing page one that afternoon?
So what I tend to do is whenever I'm working on a new piece of fiction, I have to do it pen to paper and I have to do it outside the house. So I write a lot of my initial drafts on public transport. So I ride buses for sometimes the whole day, and that's where I'll do a draft. The ideas I kind of keep listing in the kind of drafts of my iPhone, or I have loads and loads of notebooks, and I'll just pick an idea and I might start lots of different stories on the same day and see how far I get. But once I have those drafts that I've written out and about, that's when I have to sit down and start typing it up. And I try not to think about it. I just type everything I've written down in those notes. And then it's the process of redrafting, which is where things get harder.
And just to go back quickly to the bus thing, which I'm mildly intrigued by. So do you just hop on a bus and go from sort of end to end, or do you sort of have an idea about places you want to go? Is the external view and location important to that, or you just because you find that a headspace where you can really shut everything else down?
I think it's the movement, and yeah, it is basically I just get on a bus. I get on, you know, from Brixton to Oxford Circus or Euston, and that will give me about 60 minutes to sit down and not be really distracted by anything in the home. You know, it's that idea of like, I'm stuck on this, you know, I'm stuck in this place, but I am on the move. So it doesn't feel claustrophobic like it would being in a room at home. It's kind of tricking myself that I'm free, but actually I have to cement myself to a seat on a bus so that I don't get distracted. And
is that when you would be going into Oxford Circus anyway and you choose to get the bus rather than the underground, or do you just get up in the morning and think, I'm going to get on the next bus and see where it goes?
I literally will get up, have breakfast, leave the house, get on a bus. I don't even think about it, and it sounds kind of crazy, but ever since I've been freelance, it's become such an important part of my routine that it's not like I'm going off to run errands or even to meet people, though I do try and set multiple coffees in the week to meet with friends or editors or other translators, so that I do get that social aspect of my life as well. But really the point is just the travelling for the sake of travelling. So sometimes I'll get off the bus at Oxford Circus and then get on another bus and do it all again, or just get the bus back to Brixton.
You don't just get on a random bus, like you've never ended up in sort of Bedford or anything?
No, I'm a bit too... I need a bit of control, so I don't think I could get on a random one. Maybe I should. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? I'll just get to the end of the line, go back.
Yeah, I mean, you could get stuck in Bedford.
Do you have favourite buses as well? Is there some routes that you favour over others?
Well, you're getting a bit of a routine of what ones go from where you go. So often I like getting the bus to Liverpool Street. I'm currently doing a PhD in Norwich, so I got used to getting the bus to Liverpool Street at like 6 in the morning to go get a train to go to Norwich. And I would write on that bus before, you know, lockdown. and the same coming back. But then I got used to quite liking that journey, and then walking to Brick Lane and then getting another bus from like Shoreditch. It sounds crazy saying it out loud about riding buses all day, but it's such a productive part of my practice, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you might feel that we're focusing too much on the bus element, but maybe this is all because we're in lockdown and we're
I miss the buses so much. Yeah, I feel about it today of like, there's one thing I want to do is I want to go and get on a bus.
You'll live that dream one day soon.
Yeah.
So with the notes that you've produced then, and you say this sort of work starts, how kind of nebulous and stuff are the notes? Do you sometimes have placeholder text that just says, oh, there needs to be something here, and you have no idea what it is? Or do you, by the time you start to transfer it from it being the longhand pen to paper notes you've done, have you got a kind of good idea about what the shape of everything is?
Yeah, I think that if I want to get as much done on paper as possible, because the moment it transfers to the computer, that's when I start overthinking things. So the notes will be, they might be placeholders of, like, you know, and here you really have to have a piece of detailed description, or you need to look up something, or like this needs a bit of research. But the dream is to have been able to get into enough of a trance to write as much as possible in the voice of the character or characters that I'm trying to do. And the starting point for my stories is often a question. Fiction for me is me trying to answer questions. So it might be, you know, how could I answer this question in one scene, or even one sentence, one line of dialogue, and then really try and build out from there, like you would in an essay where you have to extrapolate and bring in more examples and other abstract ways of answering that question.
And is that what you're, are you writing the notes? Is that question something you'd sort of actually write on the page, or is that the questions going through your head and you start writing in the voice of a character that can answer that question as you're on the bus?
Yeah, I think with every story that I've written, I've started with a singular question, and then what happens is, yeah, I'll be starting to write and I'll think, you know, who would be approaching this question, or who could I use to demonstrate what I'm thinking about this question? And then obviously questions produce more questions, so that's how the story grows, is you come up against more and more questions about the way that the story is progressing. So it's like, well, where do we go from here now? How are we going to then take it to this next level? Or how are they going to reach a conclusion? You know, how's this character going to find the answer to my question in the way that they can answer that question? And sometimes the answer doesn't come till right at the end of the drafting process. I don't usually start with an answer. It's really the question, and I'm hoping that I'll get an answer through the process of writing the whole story. And sometimes I'll write the whole thing and I'll think, oh, I don't know if I agree with what my conclusions are, and that can be quite difficult. You know, do I keep it quite natural, or do I then have to go back and change things in order for the conclusion to sit well with me?
And have you tended to fall one side or the other with that?
Well, I do feel a bit of a, like, ethical, moral standpoint as a writer. It's something that I think runs through everything I do. So even the translating, or, you know, being part of music scenes, it's you know, living and writing as a way that expresses what you think is right. So it's not that my writing is didactic, but I, you know, wouldn't be comfortable having, say, something that's really apolitical or doesn't offer up a very strong answer that might, you know, it might change someone's life or get someone to think about something that they wouldn't have thought about before, that I think is really important, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever find your writing it goes in a way that doesn't sort of align with that, and you have to sort of backtrack and start again or revise some of it? Or is that those aspects are something that naturally come out as you explore the questions?
Yeah, I think even once a story is finished, there are a few stories where I then look at them again and I see them in completely different light, and I think, I'm sure other people have come to different conclusions than the one that maybe I was aiming for. So I guess I query whether I've always been successful in communicating what I was grasping for. And you obviously haven't really got much of a control of that as a writer. There's already stories in my collection where people have said what they got out of it, which wasn't what I was aiming for. But that's what also is very interesting about writing, how people see other things in it.
I mean, have you ever felt that someone's really fundamentally got something wrong in their interpretation of it? Or do you feel that it is just in the eye of the reader, as it were?
I mean, it is totally in the eye of the reader. And if I was really explicitly wanting someone to have a fundamental conclusion, then maybe fiction wouldn't have been the right form, because there's always a flexibility in interpretation. And it's not my place to say you're wrong as the reader. It's never been like misappropriated or I feel like someone's dangerously misunderstood what my writing is getting at.
I'm gonna guess that would be an interesting experience in itself, alongside all the problems that might come up in that. But
when you're writing fiction, is there something that draws you particularly to writing fiction rather than non-fiction or other forms that are maybe more concrete in what they're saying about a particular question?
Yeah, I think I write across many genres. I've written poetry and essay and review and columns and fiction, and now working on a PhD, I'm back to writing academically, which is shocking. But they all have their own roles, and I have different motivations with why I would choose one or the other. There's instances where I've had the same idea and I've tried to express it in poetry and fiction and essay, and I think it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. You can do it across different modes. So I'm sure I've talked about translation and what I think about translation in every form going in terms of writing, and I'm not even sure how common it is for writers to use many modes. To me, it's always been quite natural to try a bit of everything, because it will do different things.
What do you feel fiction does, like prose fiction, in comparison to those other forms? What is it that makes that stand out as a distinct form for you?
I think how expansive you can be in terms of character. And I think the reason why I always wanted to have a short story collection, even more than a novel, was because it's super challenging. It's challenging for me anyway, in trying to encapsulate character, one or more, in a really believable way in such a short space of time, and to try and encapsulate a whole world in 20 pages or 10 pages or 5 pages. So it has those challenges, and I write in a very straightforward way, which also I do in poetry and essay. So sometimes it feels like it's purely a formalistic thing rather than even a language thing or a way of expressing myself. It's more like the space around it, or whether it's to be read or to be read out loud. I don't know.
How do you mean you write in a very straightforward way? I'm just interested in what you mean by that particularly.
Well, I think that sometimes my language choice can be very straightforward. So I don't think that I'm a flowery writer. Not that I don't enjoy reading really beautifully crafted, immaculate, very evocative prose. It's just something that I've never really done. But I suppose it's not my place to decide what my writing is like. I mean, other people might disagree with that.
You can look at flowery writing as opposed to more direct. And is that something that you? I mean, do you edit heavily once you've got a draft? Do you kind of find yourself going through and removing phrases that seem too flowery, or does it just naturally that's the way the prose kind of comes together?
Yeah, I was never heavy editor. I think because I've always wanted time to be a constraint of mine, because I would hear from other writer friends who would spend, you know, a year writing a short story, and I couldn't ever imagine doing that just because of how exhausting it is to carry around a story in your mind. I have to do it within a couple of days. I never spend longer than maybe 2 days working on a story. I mean, some of the longer ones, they had more drafts than the shorter ones, but it's important to me that there is this immediacy and that I don't make really overwrought prose. And yeah, sometimes I do go into the prose and strip it out of anything I think is too much, but it really depends on the character as well. It comes from, I think, reading a lot of fairy tales, and you know, how straightforward and basic they are as modes of storytelling, that it's almost like I want to take out anything superfluous. But there are stories in the collection that maybe are more expansive, where I've really focused on language and imagery, where I've allowed myself to be a bit decadent.
I mean, I'm really surprised to hear that you write them in such a short amount of time, because they're very, I mean, while the language isn't sort of overly ornate, to use your term, or doesn't really sort of draw attention to itself, I think just sort of structurally and the leanness of them, that does surprise me. But it's very interesting. And how, in terms of putting them together as a collection, are they all edited as far as they're going to be before you put them together, or do you then sweep through again and sort of refine them to see how they fit together as pieces?
So when I gave Jess Chandler the stories, I think there was about 15 or 16, and she picked out, I think, 12 of them, and then I submitted 3 more, and she picked 1 more of those 3. And it really was to do with thematics or the form that they took. So I had some more experimental stories, but they just didn't really fit with what we had already. So we had like a strong foundation of a dozen stories, and that kind of dictated the feel of the book. Once we had them, a couple of them did need some further editing just because they weren't as tight as the other ones. So it's mainly the longer ones, like the Amnesty, I think maybe had the most editing, just to move parts around and to make sure the two voices were different enough. But it wasn't too strenuous an edit once everything came together. But some of these stories are very old. I mean, now I think all of the stories have been published elsewhere, and some of them, you know, I'd written and published maybe like 8 or 9 years ago. So I feel like they'd had their time of editing, and I didn't want to go back and rework them.
Even though, in the sort of intervening 8 years or so, you're sort of still happy with the shape and everything. I don't know. I feel like I'm someone who just wants to fiddle all the time. Nothing is ever finished enough. You know, I always want to go through and start pulling bits out. But I can see what you mean. Yeah, especially if they've been published elsewhere as short stories, they've had their time of being pondered over.
And I guess your editing process, it sounds as though the bulk of the story is sort of written in the longhand version before it ever goes into the computer. So you're not really editing extensively anyway. I mean, I find writing short stories, I'm writing it in the computer normally. I mean, I might have notes, but then the actual process of writing it is normally on a computer, and then the temptation is to edit, and then that temptation never seems to go away.
Yeah.
If I was coming back to something from 8 years ago, I know I would be tempted to move it around, even though a part of my head, I might think I'm happy with that, but another part of my head would just want to move things around again. But
I think that's the thing is, I think it's probably a reason why I don't write on the computer. I think that's, once it's been written down on the page in as complete as form and a form as possible, it prevents kind of really going to town on it on the computer, and the computer's more a space for moving things around and stitching things together, and yeah, adding where it needs that adding, I think.
Do you find then that you have sort of sections of the story? You, like on one bus journey, you might write so many pages that are continuous, and then, you know, later that day you're on a different bus journey and you write another set of pages that are continuous, but they don't necessarily link up initially, and that is later on that you kind of join those two parts together when you do type them up.
Yeah, and sometimes the thing will happen where I think I'm writing one story, but actually I'm writing two because of that split in time. So I think I'm writing one story across a day, but when I go to type them up, I realize that they've become two stories. So it's, it's like you take one day's work, and out of those, that one day where you think you were writing one story, then you might get three stories. So you take one for the next day on the bus, mm-hmm. or the next week, and you see how it's going to grow, how it's going to rise. Like I suppose, like when you make bread and then you split it into three sections and turn them into different things, like they started from the same place, which I suppose is where connections come from, between the stories, that maybe they all started in the same place, but then they went different places.
Hmm. And do you, as you're sort of writing in the longhand, are you writing fairly, continuously? It's in prose, or are you sort of stopping and writing a note to yourself as an unrelated thought pops up in your mind for a whole completely different story, but just a sort of one line note, you know, story about X, Y,
yeah,
and then go back to writing the prose of a particular story.
Yeah, it will be making notes in the margins for possible other stories, or like I mentioned, like popping a note in my iPhone, because I have, for every possible story or poem or essay, I'll have like a folder where I put, it'll be individual words or a line or a vague idea. But if I'm writing, it tends to be this kind of continuous go. But the moment I get an idea, I have to displace it and write it down somewhere. Otherwise, it will just get lost, or it will get absorbed in what I'm working in. And I try to, because, you know, if you've got lots of writing projects on the go, you have to be really strict at keeping them all really separate. And you might get tempted to write about something and put it in a story, but you know that you have to write, a piece of creative nonfiction or a poem on that same thing. So you have to be really strict and say, no, it has to go in this box, put it away, keep that away from what you're working on right now. Otherwise, it will get used up in that place.
And have you always been able to be disciplined about that since you've been writing seriously? Or is that from like bitter experience where something that had the juice to go somewhere else got used up?
Yeah, I think part of it is that taking writing a bit more seriously, which is or as I think has happened for me in the last few years, where you realise that you take it for granted if you have a period of time where you seem to be constantly inspired by things. And it's only when you hit a dry period where you haven't got a single idea that you realise how precious ideas are. Because if you use everything up in one go, so, you know, there are many ideas that I put in my first poetry collection, which maybe could have been stories or were parts of my life that I maybe would have explored in maybe personal essays or other projects. But I was so keen to use up everything that you're not really left with much. So now that's why I'm strict, because I would hate the idea that I would have to write something and have nothing to work with. I have to try and keep everything well designated and categorised so that I have material to work with. Even if I'm desperate to write about something, I have to put it to one side for a rainy day.
So you don't have an idea that gets so dominant that it kind of gate crashes what you're currently working on? And
Even if you get a really amazing image that's connected to something else you're working on and you're like, oh, I'll just put it in a story. But then it exists and it could end up that all my writing would be the same because I'd just be reusing the same things over and over again.
Mm-hmm. And is there a sort of set period of time that sort of gestates, and you know, you have an idea for just an image or a sort of very broad idea for a story and put it in your iPhone notes. How long before you're on a bus actually writing page one of that story? Is it the next week, or could it be 2 years later, or does it vary from story to story?
Sometimes it needs a long gestation period. So it could be that I have one image, or it's even an experience I had or a memory I have, and I have to wait really to find the connection. Other times, dependent on, say, if I've been asked to write something. I mean, that's a big thing as well, is if it's urgent, if I know I have to submit something, then I do have to go and just do it. And I have to play with what I've got, no matter how long it's had to kind of wait and think. Like I said, if I feel like I can't translate, then it's like, okay, well, if you're not translating, then you have to write. You can't just do nothing. So then that also will force my hand, because you know, I can't just sit and do nothing. I have to be constantly active in order to be able to, produce the work I do and also make a living. So, yeah. Mm.
And do you ever find, like, working across so many different formats and genres and, forms, do you have any crosstalk that you sort of think, oh, that's a great idea for a short story, and then the next day looking back at your notes, you go, no, wait a minute, that was related to something I was translating last week. I can't use that. Or, you know, is there any crosstalk, or is it fairly segmented in your head in terms of where each idea fits and
how
work kind of sits?
I feel like it's all crosstalk, but not just in terms of the writing and the translating, but just life and things I'm reading, conversations I've been having, films I've been watching. I mean, it all bleeds into one another. In terms of translating, it does influence my writing, in that translating it's kind of like getting a masterclass from a great writer every time you translate a book. You're learning different ways of writing, different chances you can take with your writing, different forms of characters and ideas. So I don't know, I feel like for my PhD, part of my PhD is I'm writing a autofictional work on being a literary translator, and I'm going to be looking back at all the authors I've translated, and I think that's when I'm going to get a lot of revelations about where I've been really influenced, where I'm going to look back and think, oh my god, that's definitely from this novel that I translated 5 years ago. Yeah.
That sounds like a really interesting project, yeah, to be able to go back and look at that in retrospect, because you've, with the very nature of translation, you've been so sort of forensically analysing someone else's work as well while you're doing it, just yes, an intellectual exercise of putting it into another language.
Yeah.
That sounds like a very interesting project.
And I think that's why I think that my prose is a bit stripped back, because, like you say, forensically analysing someone's writing, you know, I know that writing inside out, and it makes me hyper aware of my writing. My first poetry collection got translated into Argentinian Spanish, and I don't speak that language, but I would have Skype calls with the translator. And having your own writing reflected back to you from the perspective of a translator, which I'm used to being on the other end of, was so interesting, because of, I realised how dense and incomprehensible a lot of the writing was. He would ask me questions and I'd say, well, I wasn't really thinking about it when I wrote that. And he'd spend an hour trying to understand some obscure personal reference or a strange turn of phrase. So, it's really influenced how I write now, I think.
I mean, there's a really deep metafictional feedback loop you could get into,
yeah,
that, isn't there? If you're a translator, but then someone has translated your work, and then you're, yeah, I mean, that must be incredibly informative for your writing as well.
Yeah, the translator's perspective, I mean, talking as a translator, but, you know, it's, you can't get any deeper reading than being a translator. You're not only reading something, but you're deciding how you're going to re-express it. And it has to be as identical in, you know, meaning, but also mood, motivation, resonance, intention, all these things. So getting a translator's perspective, I felt very honoured that someone was spending their evenings looking at my poetry and just kind of staring into it, just shouting why into the void.
is it quite a different pace of work then to translate? I imagine there's a lot more, you've got to cross-reference things and look things up, double check. Could you imagine translating something, getting on a bus, just putting in a pair of headphones and translating longhand, or is that just anathema?
I've only done that once. I did that when I was getting really addicted to social media and being on the computer. I had to do a couple of really long train journeys, and I translated three chapters of The Pine Islands, which is a novel I translated, and I did that longhand, and it was amazing how much I managed to get down not being on the internet. But when I translate, it can be really relaxing, because the first draft, I try and aim to translate about a chapter a day for the first draft, and I won't check anything in the first draft. So I literally have the book in front of me and I type it into Word, leaving kind of dot 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 or question mark in spaces that I'm not really sure if I've understood. So the first draft is kind of just loose prose with lots of holes in it, but it means that I can get down as much as possible, and it feels like just reading, like I'm reading and then I'm just trying to input it straight into the computer without overthinking it. And then it's only the subsequent drafts where it is using dictionaries and cross-referencing and putting questions to the author, that's when the serious work gets in, which is where it gets harder and harder the further you get in, because right at the end you start questioning everything that's come before it.
So do you have one draft in the original and your translation, and then when you're going through for the second time, you're comparing the two side by side and tweaking.
Yes. So it's double checking everything. So even if it's a word that I'm positive about or a turn of phrase, I check it again. Everything gets checked in the second draft. And then around about the third draft, it's making decisions if I've still left in multiple words that I haven't made a decision on. And hopefully by the draft 4 or 5, it's just reading it as if it was an English piece of writing to see if it reads well, if it reads like a piece of English literature.
Yeah. When you say read, do you read out loud? And
yes.
And do you do that with your own writing as well when you finished a short story?
Yeah, I read everything out loud. Like even reviews sometimes, I try and read them out loud because I've never found grammar and punctuation very natural. And actually it was when I was working on my first collection of poetry, the poet Jack Underwood very kindly offered to read through my manuscript. And he pointed out to me that it seemed that sometimes I was doing line breaks quite randomly, or, you know, where I put a comma or a full stop had been done maybe without really thinking about it. And he explained how, you know, how grammar and punctuation is to really help the reader. It's not just to make it look nice and neat. It's to really give the reader cues. And since then, I found reading out loud helps me to check that I've put in the clues for the reader, so, you know, to indicate to them when they should have a pause or where there should be a bit of space in between lines and things like that. So I find that very useful.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting take on grammar, I think. And I think too often it's kind of taught as a set of rules that are just what should be done without any thought behind it. I think most people kind of take grammar to not to have that significance of something to help people understand,
but yes.
It's just, well, that's the way it works, which is not really so helpful. I think that kind of view of things to see that the punctuation is there to further or expand the understanding of a text is, yeah, that's the right way to look at it.
Yeah, I think because at school, yeah, everything was quite intuitive. So, you know, I still don't really know the difference between, well, I don't really know like what an adverb or a verb or a noun is, which sounds crazy because my whole life is words. But basically, I just didn't pick these things up at school. And I was really scared of things like grammatical rules. And I didn't, yeah, like you say, I didn't really see the point in it. But when I learned and came to the understanding that it's to make a text accessible, you know, it helps a text be penetrable, that's when I became so much more interested in the way I constructed my sentences.
When did you start learning German? Have you sort of always spoken, or is that something you've learnt when you were kind of growing up? Or?
I did an A-level in German and French, but I was the only person in my school that did languages post 16, so I did them on my own.
Oh wow, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, with some very overworked teachers for 2 years, and then I kind of did fine in them, you know, nothing to write home about. And then I moved to Munich when I was 18 on my own to kind of, yeah, move away, and I lived there for about a year, and my German got better, but wasn't anything special. I was still working in an English speaking office in Germany, so that kind of hindered my picking up the language. But when I came back to the UK, I just started reading German novels in the original. And in the beginning, it took a long time. The first novel I ever read, it took me about 9 months to read it. And that was, you know, using dictionaries and looking stuff up. But then the more I did it, the more I came to understand the rhythms of German literature, and I was able to kind of pick up the language from that. And also, you know, I understood how a story worked. So if there was stuff I didn't understand, you know, the vocabulary, I could fill in the gaps for myself and still get an understanding of what was going on. And then I did an MA in German studies, so studying like German modern art and German modern literature. And I got an email out of the blue asking if I wanted to translate a book for young people. And I'd never translated a sentence before in my whole life. And I just sat down with this book and then I translated it and I just could do it. and I went from there. So I'm currently working on my 15th and 16th full-length book translations.
And I mean, your translations have, yeah, I mean, they've got some sort of serious exposure and have been up for some really impressive international prizes, haven't they, as well? So that's an incredible route. I half expected you to say, oh, you know, I don't know, from a parent or something, oh, yeah, I sort of grew up speaking German. That's a really incredible route.
It's a bit of a weird route, but it worked for me, I think, because, as I said, I've never been, well, I wasn't very kind of good at things like grammar or like language learning really at school. It wasn't really for me, but I was always into writing and being a creative writer. So it was this perfect marriage between being a creative writer and just being really curious and still being really curious about the German language. So that's kind of how I got to it.
And what was it that took you to Munich at 18? Was there, it doesn't seem an obvious destination for.
I know.
I can't imagine there's many 18-year-olds leave the UK to go to Munich.
I know. It will, obviously, I'd never really left my kind of small town. So I'm from a place called Shoreham by Sea, which is near Brighton on the south coast. And I just never left Shoreham. And a woman came to our school right at the end of my A-levels who had gone to our school, had ended up going to, I think, Cambridge to study modern languages. And she said, if anyone would like to come spend some time living in Munich, you can stay with me for a couple of weeks. So I said, I want to. And I did. And then I ended up getting a job and a flat and just staying. So that's how it happened. But then I came back to start my undergrad at Goldsmiths, where I did media and modern literature. So that's why I didn't stay longer.
When did you do the MA in German? Like after?
It was, yeah. So I had a year where I moved back to Brighton and commuted for 1 year doing the MA. And then moved back to London to do the second year. So I graduated on the MA in 2012.
And with German having worked out so well for you, have you started turning your arm to other languages?
Yeah, well, I'm currently doing Italian on Duolingo.
Right.
But the main reason for that is because my dad's Maltese. But me and my brother weren't brought up with Maltese. And Maltese is a Sicilian Arabic dialect. So Italian would be a very useful language for it, as well as a friend of mine, Ruth, who's a translator from German, Russian and Arabic, gave me a weekend mini 101 in Arabic a few weeks ago. to teach me a bit about the Arabic sentence structure. Because, yeah, Maltese is like Italian, but with an Arabic sentence structure.
As in, okay, so like it's a Semitic language, but it's got lots of Italian vocabulary.
Yes.
Okay. That must be an interesting, yeah, I don't know if I really know Maltese, but
I imagine the translation pool is slightly smaller for Maltese.
Yeah, there's hardly any Maltese literature that gets translated into English, although it does often get self-translated because many Maltese authors are fluent in English. But my dad's quite funny because he's always considered German to be a very kind of honourable, useful language to have, but with Maltese, he's just like, why bother? No one speaks it, but it's a really beautiful language.
Yeah, sort of, I feel it's a bit of a shame if you've grown up with a parent who can speak another language and then haven't learned. See, that's the thing. I mean, just to drift off into my life very quickly, my toddler, her mother speaks Slovene, so we've been trying really hard to make sure that we pass that on as she's grown up. But it's at the moment, it seems okay because her vocabulary is not that large anyway, and at the moment I still know what the Slovene word is. She hasn't left me for that, but I already know that with counting she does 1, 2, 3 and you think, right, that's the nail in that coffin of being really bilingual somehow. If that's the primal thing will be in her mind, it will always be English by default.
Well, it can be very complicated. As I know some friends where, again, they're bringing their kids up bilingual, and each, I think they've got 4 kids, and each child has such a different relationship to those 2 languages. And it can be something that changes over time. So sometimes bilingual kids don't really come into their second language till they're in their teens, or they swap which is their dominant language, or they're completely bilingual. I find bilingualism so fascinating, mainly because it's an experience that I didn't have kind of growing up, I think. So, you know, I don't,
We always seem to think of it as some sort of superpower. Being able, I'm saying this as someone who is essentially monolingual, but the vast majority of the world seems to speak at least one language. So yeah, we get this very set, and we just think it's so difficult. I can't, you know, how do people begin to do it? But yeah, just if you have to, you have to, and everyone's brain should have that kind of plasticity to do it.
Yeah, I think. If you're brought up with it, like, yeah, my dad can speak 4 languages, but he doesn't see it as a superpower because that's just his life. Whereas with me, I'm still shocked that I can speak another language, and I'm really fascinated with it. And it's become my obsession is translation and how you know, live in that in-between world between languages.
Do you think that it influences your English? I mean, obviously it must do, at least subconsciously, but are there times where you find a turn of phrase that's come about because you had to finesse something from German into English?
Yeah, there's times when I use German expressions, but kind of at my own anglicized German expressions. One annoying thing I do, because I find it so useful. So in German, you know, in English, when at the end of a sentence, you might say, right, and like as a question. In German, you say, or. So I do that all the time. I say, yeah, we're going to go to the swimming pool, or.
People are waiting for or what?
Yeah. But for some reason, in my head, it makes so much more sense to say, or. To open up like the possibility for an alternative from the other person, whereas for some reason by saying right, it seems passive aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. And are you working on something like today? Have you been writing with the not being able to use the buses and all?
So I'm been working on the PhD stuff. So I've been working on writing about a pamphlet essay by Maureen Freely, who's a very well-known author and translator from Turkish. And she wrote this amazing essay called Angry in Piraeus, which is about her experience of translating the Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk. And it's a really beautiful pamphlet, just about how translation affected her writing and also her quite fraught working relationship with Pamuk. And so I've been writing part of my thesis on this essay.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah, yeah. The relationship with the author is an interesting. And do you generally work quite closely with people when you're translating them?
Or? Yeah, I really love to. It's always quite a big ambition of mine to really, not necessarily make friends, but that can be a really nice kind of side effect, but more to get a really close collaboration with an author, which I found that on the whole, authors are very much up for. So trying to like break down that hierarchy between the author kind of making all the decisions and getting kind of their way with everything, and more it being a very close collaboration where we're creating a new text together. And I've become, yeah, really close friends with a couple of my authors.
That's interesting, because a lot of the authors we've spoken to for the podcast so far, they've almost the other extreme of, they generally sort of said that, yeah, that my translations, I don't get involved at all. I don't want to have any conversations about it. I give it to the translator and I trust they're good. And I've got good translators, so they are good translations as far as I know, but I don't get involved. Like it feels like we've heard that quite often from authors that we've spoken to whose work's been translated.
Yeah, it really depends. Like I've had authors who've said, I'm really busy, I really won't have time to talk to you about it at all. And then you have to kind of get on with it. But then other authors, I've gone on residencies with them and kind of sat next to them for like a week. And we've sat and gone through everything, sometimes, you know, line by line in a chapter, just to discuss really what's going on, because it's a great opportunity for me as a translator to just listen to the way the author talks about their writing. The first book I translated for adults, which was a memoir called Nicotine by Gregor Hens, I remember reading it and thinking it was very solemn and very serious. And then I got to meet Gregor and he had a very dark sense of humour. You know, we went and had coffee and had like a long chat about his work translating Will Self into German. And I left that conversation just after one coffee, having a completely different feel of what the book was. So sometimes it feels like the translation would have been completely different if I hadn't have met authors. But sometimes, yeah, I mean, authors don't get paid to work with translators. They've got other work to do. So it really is also up to them whether they want to sacrifice that time. But I think it does really add something to the translation.
Yeah, I mean, particularly as you were saying, this sort of to get a completely, not completely different understanding of the work, but to just have a different light thrown on it by actually seeing the personality that is producing it.
Yeah, just to get that perspective on another possibility of who that person is, because obviously everything should be in the text in terms of the voice, the material, like it's all there. But it was interesting then reading it in his voice, in the same voice I'd heard him talk about, you know, his life and these anecdotes and things. And it's, I just thought, if I hadn't have met him, I wouldn't have even considered it a possibility that this line was meant to be funny, or that, you know, that he has this dryness. So yeah, it was very helpful.
Well, thank you to Jen for joining us, and thank you for listening. We'll put some information about where you can find out more about Jen's writing in the episode notes below this podcast.
If you enjoyed listening to the podcast, do find us and rate us wherever you find this podcast. And you can tweet us on Twitter at Unsigned Methods, or visit our website at unsignedmethods.co.uk.
I mean, spread the word. This is a time for making podcast hay, I think, while people are locked down and listening. So if you like this podcast and you know someone else who is writing or wants to write and they're just looking for a bit of inspiration, please spread the word. Yeah. If you're interested, you can find out more about me and my writing at jamiebatchen.com, or I'm on Twitter at jamiebatchen, or on Instagram at jamie_batchen.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
I mean, I do realise now that we have a Facebook page, but we never publicise it. There is a Facebook page with the episodes on. Feel free to follow us and interact there.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Take care.